You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the SEA. You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the SEA.
Hello and welcome to episode number 179 of the Fabulous Pelton Cast. I'm your co-host Kevin Pelton.
And I'm Tristan Carcino.
And we are coming to you from Renton, Washington, home of the Super Bowl 48 champion Seattle Seahawks.
Hello!
Well, it's a big
Spirit
episode
of 79 edition.
Oh, I didn't think about that. Yeah. Go check out that podcast on the 79 championship Sonics, the two-parter. But this is we got a big one in store for you. Obviously, a lot of football going on right now. Playoff soccer in Seattle for two teams. But also, we would be remiss if we didn't mention this week, if we didn't pour one out, which we'll have to get to our beer in a second here, for the final episode of Ballers on HBO, which at the end of this episode, the last ever After Ballers with special guest, third Pelton brother, DJ Infrared.
Wow.
Had to do it to him.
All right. We had to do it to him in the same way that The Rock had to do this final season of Ballers on HBO.
He sure did. So we are drinking this week from our friends at Drecker Brewing Company in Fargo, North Dakota.
Oh, good friends.
It's part of their Valhalla series. The Thor is my co-pilot lactose double IPA. We're back to the lactose. As usual, our beer is sponsored by Tavor. Tavor is an app that offers craft beers like this one that aren't distributed nationwide for purchase. Local breweries send their beers to Tavor. You order the ones you like, and they'll be shipped together on a regular basis for a flat shipping cost. We're drinking beer sent to us by Tavor on the pod each week, and you can take advantage, too, if you sign up for an account with Tavor and enter the code PELTONCAST in the promos section on the app. You'll get $10 credit after spending your first $25 with Tavor. So let's crack these bad boys open. A little lactose double IPA at 11:30 at night. Okay, so first, obviously, we do have to toast to the final episode of Ballers. But also, a toast to the Mariners, who, as of tonight, are now the only remaining active MLB team not to make the World Series.
Wow.
Because the Washington Nationals made it for the first time in their franchise's history, dating back to its time in Montreal.
You know what the thing is? Every other franchise has made the World Series. Teams make the World Series every year, two
wow.
of them. Honestly, not making the World Series is more impressive than making the World Series. There's only one team ever who hasn't made the World Series, and that is your Seattle Mariners, people. This is history.
I mean, I feel like the Washington Senators, I don't know if they made it before they moved to Texas. I don't know how we count that, but you know, there's probably some other franchises that have done it.
They are
history.
History. Right here in the making, in the city of Seattle.
All right, also a toast to UW alum Matisse Thybulle, who made his first preseason start.
I thought we were toasting to Zendaya. No.
On Tuesday. And well, I'm told that was actually a deep fake.
Oh!
Yeah. I'm told that relationship is not real. But
deep fake?
Yeah, we'll see if we get more information on that. But I have some Sixers sources.
Oh, wow. You kept your
They're not actually part of the organization, to be clear. But, you know, sources who follow the Sixers.
Uh-huh.
But he did make that first preseason start on Tuesday night, finished with 7 points, 6 rebounds, and 4 steals in 25 minutes, all but locking up a spot in the rotation for the upcoming season for the Sixers.
All right.
It was so much fun because, you know, the one thing you worried about a little bit is, you know, Thybulle was so dominant in the 2-3 zone under Mike Hopkins.
Who made the deep fake?
I don't know. I'm not sure.
Was Matisse behind this?
Unclear. I don't know that much information.
Who is interested? Just Matisse Thybulle is so strange, right? If you're going to do a deep fake of Zendaya being in a relationship,
I mean, probably would be a Sixers fan then, right?
Okay.
I would imagine something like that. I don't know if you've aware of this. Sixers have some fans who spend a lot of time. They're very online.
Okay.
The Sixers fans. Anyways, like, it was fun to see Matisse doing all the things in the NBA that he did at UW. He blocked Thonmaker's shot from behind early in the game. He had a bunch of steals. He missed a three. It was just like old times. No, he made a three as well. I'm kidding. Had a bunch of offensive rebounds. That actually was kind of atypical of his UW time.
Well, we have... Do you have any more toasts?
No.
We have so much sports to get to. I feel like we need to get straight into the sports. It is such a...
We can't even talk about going to the Bay Area, your first ever time going to La Taqueria.
Oh, I guess we do have to talk about
that. Yeah, we got to talk about that. Wait, I mean, we don't have to talk extended about that, but...
Wait, let me finish what I was just going to say, though.
Okay. Your spiel?
There are so many good sports happening this weekend, and important sports happening, that I know you've been considering calling it the most important sports week ever. You've been thinking about it. I can see it in your eyes.
I honestly did not think about it.
You've been thinking about cursing the city of Seattle this weekend and calling it the most important sports week ever.
Wow.
Just don't do it to them.
Maybe I should have.
Maybe we should just talk about food.
That's actually a good idea. So
you're not going to like my takes.
Oh, no. So we were in the Bay Area last weekend. I was there for 4 days. You were there for less than 24 hours. And sadly, it was not a trip that was centered on eating. So while I had some fine, like high quality food at, you know, like a random noodle shop, a knife shaved noodle shop in Oakland, downtown Oakland, in Oakland Chinatown, some good Thai in San Francisco. The only notable things I had was I did get to El Farolito with our third Pelton brother, Nate Duncan.
Okay.
And kind of reconfirmed to me that it's not quite as good as La Taqueria, which you went to.
I went to La Taqueria for the first time ever.
Yeah.
And it confirmed to me that it's just a fine burrito.
Wow.
It's a good burrito.
So you don't think it was the best burrito you've ever had?
Definitely not.
What is the best burrito you've ever had?
The best burrito that I've ever had is from La Posadita in Chicago.
Which is the one I went to in May, correct? Yeah.
And it might have been because the Posadita burrito really surprised me. I didn't realize that I was having like a world-class level burrito at the time. But this burrito, like...
Whereas this one had the weight of expectations and the 45-minute wait.
Emphasis on the word wait.
Yeah.
But it was like, I went into this with people telling me this would be the best burrito that I ever had. And really, I was just like, what is so special about this burrito? Tell me what it is.
It's just the quality of all the ingredients is so high, and then the care with which it's made. Like,
so the positives that I will give to you is every bite was basically like equally the same.
That's a huge thing.
There were no
garbage
bites. We've
talked about this.
And the meat, I think it was clearly very high quality meat, and it was really smoky. And it was just like, oh, wow. But to me, the tortilla at La Posadita, where it's like freshly cooked and just gooey, I'm like, that, it was the best tortilla that I've ever had. It was a no-frills burrito. We're talking, it's basically just meat and onions up in there. It was perfect. And this burrito was good. It really, and I know this is
heresy,
it doesn't rise that far above the level of like random food truck burrito to me.
Oh, that is offensive.
If I lived in San Francisco, I would probably never go there.
First off, you can go there at off hours if you live there in San Francisco, not
or
during
maybe,
the middle of Saturday.
Maybe I would, and I would go at off hours and be like, this is very good. Maybe I'd explore it. You know, I'd explore the studio space and really find the burrito that made the most sense. I had two baby burritos today from Tacos Chuy's, and they weren't my favorite baby burritos I've ever had. I was at the South Lake Union location. But
yeah, I didn't have a great... I went there for lunch last week, and it wasn't as great as the other times I've gone to the South Lake Union location.
But... I would probably, it's tough. I would maybe choose two baby burritos over the La Taqueria burrito.
Man. So I went to El Farolito on Thursday night after going to the Warriors game at the new Chase Center, and had gone to this noodle shop that I mentioned where I ordered like some spare ribs and some noodles in spicy broth, and the noodles in the broth came, the bowl was so much bigger than I expected, and I still finished almost all of it. And it was like, I don't know if I'm not going to be able to eat again tonight. And Nate wanted to go to El Farolito, and I'm like, I might eat like half a burrito. Like, I've gotten a little bit hungry. But then I nearly finished the entire thing because it was so phenomenal. I mean, and still not quite as good as La Taqueria, because I do think it gets a little dry. There's sections where it's like mostly rice and beans, and you need the salsa that they provide there to give you a little bit of wetness to that. And I think that's what differentiates it from La Taqueria, but they're both amazing burritos.
Okay.
All right. Well, I also went to Burma Superstar, which is my other favorite location in the Bay.
Picking up what you're putting down with these noodles and this K barbecue. That's what I'm wanting.
No, it wasn't K barbecue.
Just, what was it?
Like spare ribs, like sort of thing.
Man. But I still want those noodles.
Yeah, I mean, they were really good. So we went to Burma Superstar also with Nan on Sunday, and it remains outstanding. Like, anything you get on the menu is so good there. That's my take. Go to Burma Superstar. Go to the Oakland location if you can, because there's not a long wait like there is at the San Francisco location. Now, should we get to sports?
All right.
Let's start with the NBA Seattle update, sponsored by Pagliacci Pizza.
Because Pagliacci wants basketball back in Seattle. And so do we. And we witnessed that in their short feature on the Pelton Cast on the Pagliacci blog. Did we mention this last week?
No, it came out after last week. We recorded last week, so.
Finally, some Pelton Cast press.
Yeah, I mean, thanks so much to Pagliacci for writing up why they decided to sponsor the Pelton Cast and talking about our love for Seattle sports and their love for Seattle sports.
Mm-hmm. All of our best press is sponsored content.
Yes, so check that out if you haven't already. Not a lot, I think, of NBA talk this week. I considered whether we should discuss the latest episode of the Ringer's podcast on Luminary Sonic Boom, on Howard Schultz, the kind of rise and fall of his ownership of the Sonics, but I'm not sure I can trust you with that topic.
Spoiler alert, you can't.
I was going to talk about how they kind of got into this a little bit, but like the excitement about when Howard Schultz first bought the team, because it was like right after Mark Cuban bought the Mavericks and pumped so much money into them. And we're like, okay, it's going to be the same thing where this young entrepreneur buys the team and suddenly invests a lot. And that didn't really take.
They nailed everything.
But they also, they mentioned my former coworker, Jeremy Rapanich, mentioned the speeches that Howard Schultz did.
That was the one thing, because we went to those.
We did. He was talking about it was like for business types, like guys who wear jackets and go to bars and drink like old fashions. Uh-huh. It was his description of it.
Manhattans or something.
Whatever it was. And it was like, it was all of them. And then it was 16-year-old Tristan.
Don't forget Jan. Jan was in Kevin. The house.
Oh, she sure was.
I felt like they really nailed the Howard Schultz experience pretty perfectly, though.
I agree with that.
And really just, it's shocking because the whole thing about it was, and we've talked about our feelings about Howard Schultz fairly extensively here. Just how
possibly too extensively.
Just how brief it was, though.
Yeah, I mean, it really was. It was 5 years from when he, 5 and a half when he purchased the team to when he sold it.
Uh-huh.
Or when that group. Sometimes we are in, he was obviously the head of that group, but as was pointed out, it did include 58 people.
Why did it have to include 58 owners? That's what I didn't get.
That was like, mentioned in there because of the fact that so many people lost money when
didn't Howard Schultz have the money himself?
Yeah, I guess he just wasn't willing to. I mean, he might not have had that much liquid money because a lot of it was tied up in Starbucks stock. So
he really specializes in liquid money, am I right?
What?
Because their product is liquid.
Oh, I see. Okay, yeah. That's pretty good. I'll give you that one. Okay, also while we're here this week, this is the last call for the Pelton Cast Fantasy Basketball League. People have really stepped up to the table with awesome creative team names based on Seattle food. If you can't come up with one, I have one that I'm saving for someone who asks for it.
Wow, you don't want to just throw it out there?
Well, I mean, maybe. All right, I'll throw it out there.
All right, let's hear it. Here we go.
So these are based off, we should go into the league and go through them. They're based off Seattle food restaurants and NBA players is naturally one does.
I want to hear what Katie's come up with.
Katie has not yet signed up for the league, even though she's agreed to participate in it. So I think the first one was Maono Ginobili. Or no, that was the second one. That was by, who copped to that one? I don't know who copped to that one. The original one was by the listener Michael Reinhardt, who went with Taco Time Northwest, Taco, TACKO, after yes. Taco Fall, the Celtics rookie. And elsewhere in this league, the founder slash commissioner of it,
Noah Cohen, just read through the names.
Went with, I was loading it, Pagliacci Pizza. DJ Infrared, who you'll be hearing from later, went with Tats Lever. So I think those are the only ones that are Seattle, specifically Seattle restaurant
Tats
related.
Lever?
Yeah.
Wow.
So my submission for this was Tacos Chuki's Atkins.
What? This was the gold that you were like, I need to save this for somebody?
Yeah.
Tacos Chuki's Atkins? Okay. Yeah. So the thing about the Howard Schultz podcast that was that I feel like the thing that they missed was just how bad of a decision it was to sell the team when they did.
I mean, that may come up in a future episode.
Okay. Because that to me is the real, like, there were a lot of problems with the story, but just the short-sightedness of it, you know, like the not recognizing what was about to happen within 5 years, right?
It was probably longer than that. It was until after the lockout. I think the team values really accelerated. Okay, maybe so it's probably like 7 or 8 longer. Years.
But we're not talking about a long time. And it's not like the team values just rose. They rose astronomically.
Oh, I mean, if the Sonics were in Seattle now, I mean, depending on what the arena situation was, they'd be worth, you know, approximately $2
billion. $2 billion. Yeah,
a little less than 6 times what they sold for in 2006. So, yeah.
So that to me was the biggest issue. Do you think from your perspective, as you worked for the team while Howard was there?
Yes.
Do you think he didn't connect with the players in the way that they were describing?
I don't have any unique insight to that. So.
Okay.
I mean, I don't know if GP is the best spokesman for it. I will say, GP's extension request was presented as like a little more like, oh, all I wanted was a new contract. Like, no big deal. Like, GP, you wanted a max deal, and within a year, at like when your contract expired, granted he probably took less money, but he signed for the mid-level with the Lakers, and then he signed with the mid-level after that with the Celtics, and was like in the fringes of being out of the league by the time that extension would have ended. It would have been a disaster. And I love Gary Payton. I'm just saying.
I mean, what it would have been a disaster and the team would have moved. Like, well, the worst thing that could have happened. It doesn't really matter. Like, the one thing that we don't get is, I had actually forgotten that Desmond Mason was part of that trade.
I mean, they didn't quite go into this, but I think that's when his heart really went out of it.
Howard.
Because of the fact that, like, he disliked Gary Payton so much, and it, like, should have been this exciting moment. He got rid of Gary Payton.
Uh-huh.
But it wasn't, because he had to sacrifice Desmond Mason.
I mean, he didn't have to. They could have given up other things besides Desmond Mason.
Surely
also, they didn't have to make the trade.
They kind of did, though. They got Ray Allen. I don't know if you're aware of
this. I mean, they did. But if you're telling me that Howard Schultz's heart went out of it because he had to trade Desmond Mason, so then he sold the team and lost $1.5 billion? Like,
I mean, a lot more went into it than that. I'm just saying the emotional connection part of it was never the same after that trade for him.
I mean, that to me is just emblematic of a person who shouldn't have been in the business at all. I mean, this is getting to dangerous territory for you.
I think that's the conclusion there.
But if your only care is one player on the team ever that you felt like you connected with, and when that player's gone, or like he had to realize it was a business, the same thing that 18-year-old athletes had to realize.
I mean, Desmond was a little older than 18 when he talked about it being a business, but yes.
There are 18-year-old athletes who realize this, and younger. And we're talking about a 40 to 50-some-year-old businessman, right? Who probably should have realized what the deal was before then. And that's what it... I'm just surprised. I've never heard this perspective.
Oh, yeah. Like, he was brokenhearted about having to include Desmond Mason in the trade.
Then trade some fucking draft picks! You think they wouldn't have taken 2 first-round picks instead of Desmond Mason?
Yeah.
What, did they draft Robert Swift and Mo Sene?
Well, okay. That's a separate issue. It would not have been a good basketball decision.
Honestly, how many project centers would they have had to give up instead of Desmond Mason?
Can I say something that's going to make the famous cousin Katie very upset?
What?
Robert Swift was more valuable than Desmond Mason during the time that he was on the Sonics.
This is ludicrous.
Desmond Mason was sub replacement. He was super
inefficient.
And Robert
Swift wasn't?
He was about replacement. Desmond Mason would have played a lot of minutes, and he would have shot a lot of long twos.
You're fully tripping here.
Someone that
the team
differently with hindsight
because of Desmond Mason. Would you have rather had a team plus Desmond Mason or no team,
team
plus
did not move
Mo Sene, Johan Petro, and Robert Swift?
I don't know if you're aware of this. There's going to be a lot of more episodes in this series, and they're going to go into the other reasons the team moved that aren't related to Desmond Mason.
You seem to single out Desmond Mason. The reason the team moved is because Howard Schultz lost interest in owning the team, though.
No.
And he didn't want to have the fight with the city or whatever, but
it didn't have to be a fight, as it turns out. And again, that's what they'll get into on subsequent episodes if you listen to Sonic Boom on the Luminary podcast app. Now it's time to talk about the Sounders. We're coming off the international break in between the end of the MLS regular season and the first round of the MLS Cup, which they will play Saturday versus FC Dallas at 12:30 p.m., which, as we mentioned last week, is precisely when the Huskies kick off against Oregon. In wonderful scheduling. Well done, MLS. Jordan Morris, during the week off, had a goal and three assists in the USMNT's 7-0 win over Cuba in CONCACAF Nations League action. That was, of course, followed by a 2-0 loss at Canada, the first time that the USMNT has lost to Canada since, I believe they said, 1985.
Wow.
So that wasn't great.
Look, teams have beaten Canada so many times this year.
I mean, Canada's had a solid year. They did well in the Gold Cup, I think.
There's only one team that lost to Canada for the first time since 1985, which to me is a greater achievement than beating Canada.
This is a good bet. This is a good recurring bet. One injury question for the Sounders going into this match is Victor Rodriguez, who went through three quarters of training on Tuesday, according to Sounder at Heart. The Sounders and FC Dallas, these teams drew 0-0 in September in the middle of a stretch of three games in 8 days for the Sounders. They did start a pretty normal lineup, but Morris played as a sub in that match. For Dallas, their striker Zdenek Ondrasek had a DNP. Dallas won 2-1 in Frisco back on June 1st. Ondrasek scored 5 goals, 2 off the team lead, in just 16 matches, kind of moved into the lineup at midseason. The Czech national joined FCD before the season using targeted allocation money, and he's coming off scoring in his national team debut last week for the Czech Republic. Dallas kind of average offensively, much like the Sounders, in terms of expected goals per game. 6th in expected goals allowed per game, which is better than the Sounders are at that end. Actually, they're pretty average in terms of expected goals allowed as well. So on a neutral field, you'd feel like FC Dallas has a pretty good chance of winning, but this is because of the new MLS playoff format. Is not a neutral field. It is the Sounders getting home field for this one, is the number 2 seed.
How important is home field in soccer?
It's pretty damn important. I mean, we talked about this last week. There's an enormous home-road split among pretty much all the playoff teams in the Western Conference, including both of these ones. The Sounders, during the regular season, 11-2-4 at home, losing just twice in 17 matches. And Dallas, which was 10-1-6 at home, just one loss in 17 matches, but 3-11-3 on the road, just 3 wins. So, you know, because of all that, the Sounders comfortably favored in this match when you account for it. The 538 Soccer Power Index model gives them a 66% chance of advancing to the conference semifinals.
All right.
So
let's consider the percentage chance of victory.
Yeah, I don't know if I have too much to add to that at this point. I mean, the one thing you're excited about is that hopefully the strong defense we've seen since Roman Torres returned to the lineup, that continues in the playoffs. Like, if you're looking for a reason for hope for a long playoff run for the Sounders, besides the fact that they host until the conference finals, that's it. Reign FC wrapped up the NWSL regular season with a 2-2 draw Sunday at the Orlando Pride. They took a 2-1 lead, I should say, just before halftime, but conceded the equalizer to the legendary Marta in the 86th minute. The result locked the Reign into the 4th seed in the NWSL playoffs, and they will travel to face the North Carolina Courage on Sunday at 10:30 a.m. on ESPN2. Going to be a tough challenge for Reign FC. The Courage led NWSL in both goals scored and allowed this season. They were unbeaten at home during the regular season, going 8-0-4. Led by Lynn Williams, 12 goals. USWNT's Crystal Dunn had 7 goals in just 13 matches, of course, because many of the national teamers missed an extended portion in the middle of the season. A really strong back line for the Courage with Abby Dahlkemper, Jalen Hinkle, and Heather O'Reilly, all of whom have USWNT experience. So the chances of victory not nearly as good, you would say, for Reign FC going on the road to play the top team in the league. The 538 Soccer Power Index projections give them just an 18% chance of pulling the upset.
It's not happening.
It would be pretty impressive if it did. But remember, 18% is not 0%. It is a one single hashtag game playoff, and anything can happen there. U.S. Soccer on Tuesday denied a BBC report that Reign FC manager Vlatko Andonovski will be the next coach of the U.S. women's national team, replacing Jill Ellis. That announcement is expected shortly after the end of the UNWSL playoffs. Former Reign manager Laura Harvey recently announced that she will not be the next manager of the USWNT, choosing instead to stay with the NWSL's Utah Royals. We move ahead to the UW section. Men's basketball picked third behind Oregon and Colorado in the preseason media poll revealed at Media Day last Tuesday. Jaden McDaniels and Isaiah Stewart both landed on the preseason All Pac-12 first team, made up of 10 players, I should say, because of course a team is 10 players and not 5 on the court at a time, apparently. UW subsequently picked fourth by my ESPN college basketball colleagues behind those two teams and also Arizona.
Is there a Ken Pom ranking, a preseason ranking yet?
I haven't seen that yet. He has not tweeted about it, so I'll check right now if we can fill some time.
Do you think that this is a reasonable place for them to be picked right now between Oregon, behind Oregon and Colorado after comfortably winning the Pac-12 last year, at least in the regular season, and then...
I mean, Colorado's the quality team that like has the most returning talent in the Pac-12, so that's why they're such a trendy pick.
Granted, there's not the same kind of returning talent, but the influx of talent coming in has to be the best in the Pac-12.
I mean, Arizona has like two recruits that are, you know, a similar level as Stewart and Jaden McDaniels. They have the backcourt of Nicolo Mannion and Josh Green, I believe.
Well, then you also add in Quade Green, too.
Yeah.
To a team that was much better than Arizona last year. But these teams did not
lose as much as the Huskies did.
Just because of Matisse?
I mean, they lost four players of their top six.
Okay.
At least in terms of minutes played. I mean, really in terms of quality. But
it's funny because I was the one who was very negative about this.
Yeah.
Okay, so do you think that third in the Pac-12 is good enough for an NCAA tournament berth?
I mean, the early speculation is that this will be a much better year for the Pac-12.
Uh-huh. Until you actually watch the Pac-12?
Yeah, until they lose to, like, I'm trying to think, who should they lose to in non-conference play here? Cal State Northridge? I like Cal State Northridge.
Yeah, no, and every team in the Pac-12 is going to lose to Cal State Northridge.
A lot of them will.
There's going to be losses to teams a lot worse than Cal State Northridge. It was like when people were tweeting on Sunday, Paul Gallant, who is new to Seattle, tweeted about how the Seahawks should have a comfortable victory against the Browns.
Oh,
and it was like, they're so cute when they're young.
Yeah.
You know, it's just so like naive. having a Pac-12 that's much stronger. It's like 1998 ain't walking through that door.
I think 4 Pac-12 tournament teams is realistic next year because
that's what you consider a much stronger year.
Yeah, I mean, there was 2 last year, right? No, 3, I guess. Oregon, UW, and did someone else make it in?
I'm sure somebody else made it in.
You should not be. Well,
Arizona State was in like the play-in game or something.
Yes, that would be the other one. Yes. So yeah, 4 would be pretty substantially stronger than that. Oregon only made it in as the conference champion. Remember, they weren't going to make it in otherwise.
Okay, so we can be comfortable with third preseason then.
Yeah. Yeah, I think third or fourth is about the right place for them. UW football turned things around at halftime in Tucson in a game that we were streaming on Saturday night in the Bay Area. Trailing 17-13 at the half, where, as Matt Kelkins of the Seattle Times wrote about last week, the Huskies had lost their last 10 games trailing at halftime in 15 of the last 16. But not last Saturday, good sir, as they outscored the Wildcats 38-10 on the road after halftime to run away with a 51-27 victory. Is everything fixed?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
How did they, so having not paid that much attention to this game, how did they score so many points in the second half? And why is it because of Puka Nacua?
It's not entirely because of Puka Nacua, but like the passing offense, which was anemic in the first half, really got going in a big way down the field. Nacua was a big part of it, had 3 catches for 97 yards in his breakout performance that, you know, kind of seems to signal that he's here to stay as an important contributor for the Huskies going forward. There was a 39-yard pass to Jordan Chin. Obviously, Aaron Fuller remained heavily involved in the action. And, you know, it's just It was chunk plays in the passing game. It was a strong running attack.
What do you like to call those?
Explosives?
Explosives.
I've never gotten around with that. Not fully on board with that term. The running game was really solid in this one, particularly Sean McGrew, who went over 100 yards on just 13 carries. So, I mean, there was just a lot of good things happened in the second half of this game. And then they also benefited from some short fields on their scoring drives in the second half, some Arizona turnovers. They had a 36-yard drive for a touchdown, a 20-yard drive for a field goal, a 43-yard drive for a touchdown, sprinkled in along with a 75-yard touchdown drive, or a pair of 75-yard touchdown drives and one of 63.
What about yards per play for the game in general, for the whole game?
It was good.
So, like, is the offense fixed now?
I don't know if I would want to go that far. I mean, they average 11 yards per pass attempt, 4.6 yards per carry on the ground, as compared to 6.3 yards per pass for Arizona and Khalil Tate, and 3.9 yards per rush. Also, 4 turnovers for Arizona. I think one of those was on special teams, but 3 forced by the defense.
Well, and I would assume that the previous week, their yards per pass was much worse against Stanford.
Yeah. Yeah, that'd be accurate.
So, I don't want to anoint Puka Nacua as the savior. It does feel like there's a little bit of an element of wide receivers in particular, and a certain tight end who hasn't progressed as much as we would have liked, seem to be having, and I'm not talking about Kate Otten, seem to be having...
I mean, Hunter Bryant did have some big plays. I mean, he had 3 catches for 45 yards.
I mean, we want him to be up there with Aaron Fuller, though, as the primary part of this offense, is what I'm saying.
Okay, Aaron Fuller had 1 more catch for the same amount of yards per catch.
How many catches does he have for the year? Don't even question me about Aaron Fuller right now. Aaron Fuller is the undisputed number one receiver on this team.
Sure.
He's the only player who played against Stanford. Be cool.
I'm not saying that he's bad. I'm just saying...
They need more receivers to be able to get open and then subsequently catch the ball.
Yeah.
That's it.
Okay.
Right?
I mean, Hunter Bryant had a weirdly terrible game against Stanford. I called him the weirdly terrible
game against Cal also. Is there something about the Bay Area?
I know. Maybe there is. But, you know, I tweeted about him being the best player on the offense as recently as the USC game, I'm pretty sure.
Oh, was Jacob Eason not playing in that game?
No, he was.
Was Aaron Fuller not playing in that game?
That's a fairer question.
It does feel like Eason with weapons is pretty dangerous.
I mean, the question is going to be consistency. I mean, that's what we haven't seen. And especially, you know, we'll get to this in a moment, but going up against a defense as good as Oregon's is, I'm not ready to, like, say mission accomplished just yet because of the fact that even though they won in a place that's been very difficult for them to win historically.
We will see.
Not quite Stanford level difficult to win, but difficult nonetheless.
Okay.
The other unexpected weapon for the Huskies in the past game, Jack Westover.
Hello.
Richard freshman walk-on tight end who catches a touchdown pass in this game.
Unexpected, because we had not heard of him.
That is definitely true. Is he in the NCAA football roster?
Definitely not.
So the one downer of the second half is that linebacker MG Tufisi left on a stretcher, scary-looking injury, was diagnosed with a significant stinger. And Chris Peterson said the Huskies will be cautious with him, although good news that there was not a concussion involved in this play at all.
And the Huskies seem, I feel like, the Seahawks had, I mean, Cam Chancellor basically was like out for his career with a stinger, right?
That is true, yeah.
So we definitely have seen, I feel like the Huskies in particular, though, have had some pretty bad stingers.
All right, lastly, is Oregon week? I felt we should talk about the UW-Oregon rivalry, and conveniently, the New York Times had a story on Tuesday about the website norivalry.com, which surveys fans and asks them to distribute 100 rivalry points among all the other teams they consider their rivals. So I was curious how many rival points you think.
Oh my God, I'm not going to look.
Huskies fans gave Oregon. Yeah,
okay.
Don't look at it.
Okay. This is Husky fans gave Oregon. Can we also see how many Oregon gave?
Yes, we can, which is one of the great parts of this.
This is out of 100.
Yes.
I think they gave 56. Oregon.
Did you actually not look at it?
No, I didn't look at it.
It is 56.92.
Really?
Oregon slightly less considers UW slightly less a rival. 47.
They did beat us for a decade straight.
They sure did. Wazoo, this is a much more imbalanced rivalry. We UW fans assign Washington State 28.6 rivalry points.
Uh huh.
Cougar fans, we want to guess at that one.
78.
Not quite that high. 64.9.
Who are their other rivals?
I mean, we can take a look here. I also was amused that Oregon State considered... I mean, these do seem to be kind of small samples. Yeah, I mean, it's just getting spread among a number of small teams. Idaho was the only other one that received more than 6 points from Cougar fans.
I like that 8% consider USC and only 0.33% of USC consider UW rivals.
Yeah. It really does match up pretty well. Again, the sample sizes seem quite small, but it is realistic. I think Stanford being behind Oregon State and UCLA, though, is kind of tough for me to accept. Stanford, I consider a much bigger rival.
Oh, yeah. It's been well documented how much we don't like Stanford.
I mean, maybe during the Jim Mora days, UCLA was more of a rival. But now that, I mean, I guess Chip Kelly has the Oregon connection.
God,
but
this is such an Oregon thing. Oh, my God, Oregon fans. Have some respect for yourselves.
Some self-respect.
Ohio State, not even a ranking. Ohio State is not your rival, Oregon. This is the most Oregon thing where they're like, we play at a national level.
It's 0.3 points. Let's all remain calm. They didn't even show
UW that many. Alabama and Auburn on this list. Like, are you joking?
I mean, Auburn is a rival of theirs at this point, I think. That is fair.
After today. Boise State kind of makes sense.
Dyer was
down. They had some epic showdowns with Boise State.
Troy Dye may also have been down. The Ducks come into this one, riding a 5-game winning streak dating back to that loss to Auburn. It wasn't in Atlanta, was it?
It was in Dallas. Texas.
It was at the
0.09% of Oregon fans haven't let go of it.
In that span, they have allowed just 25 points to opponents, no more than 7 in any game, leading the Ducks to the number 6 FPI ranking in terms of defensive efficiency. Really, despite all the Justin Herbert hype and despite the fact that he has a 12-1 touchdown interception ratio so far this season, this is a very defensive oriented team.
He's the Garoppolo of college football.
Believe it or not, Oregon rates worse on offense in FPI efficiency than the Huskies do, 28th to 21st. And the Huskies work slightly better on offense than defense. Also, hard to believe based on the tenor of the discussion after the Stanford game and at halftime of the Arizona game.
Can we click to vote on this?
Sure. I mean, maybe don't do it during the podcast, but, you know, after that, please do.
I'm just going to go through and rank, like, Michigan and Ohio State, the primary Husky rivals.
So Herbert is just 5th in Pac-12 QBR, which obviously does put ahead of Jacob Eason, despite that strong touchdown interception ratio.
I had to say it.
He has completed 69% of his passes, but his 12.0 yards per completion, I was giving you space to say nice there, his 12.0 yards per completion there are 10th in the Pac-12. And Herbert lost his leading receiver, tight end Jacob Breland, who has 26 catches for 405 yards and 6 touchdowns, which Tristan wants Hunter Bryant to have posted this season, to a season-ending injury in their 45-3 win on Friday against Colorado.
So this was the thing, I mean, when watching, I haven't seen that many Oregon games this year, but watched almost all of that game against Auburn. And the thing that really frustrated me the most about Herbert, especially because I was cheering for Oregon in the game, was that he's not throwing any passes downfield. It's like touchdown to interception ratio is one thing if you're completing passes for good chunks of yards. This isn't Russell Wilson with no interceptions, though. Right? This is not making big plays and then also not throwing interceptions. This is them being safe on basically everything that they're doing.
So it'll be interesting to see how they replace Breland. Nobody else has more than 300 receiving yards this season. So that's definitely been, you know, a security blanket for Herbert this season. The rushing offense has been, you know, perfectly solid, 4.9 yards per carry, coming in 5th in the Pac-12. Their two main running backs, Travis Dye and CJ Verdell, both around 6 yards per carry. But really, again, the strength of this team is the defense. Opponents are completing just 52% of their passes against Oregon, the 12th lowest mark in the FBS, for 4.8 yards per attempt, which is 2nd in the country behind only Wisconsin. Just one opponent, Montana, believe it or not, has reached 200 passing yards this season. So even when they lost that Auburn game, it was really more about the damage that the Tigers were able to do with their run game, running 43 times for 206 yards in that game, much more than their passing game. And we have seen teams run it a lot against Oregon, even while trailing. Colorado last week ran it 40 times for 168 yards in a game they lost by 6 touchdowns.
What in the... They were just so scared of the Oregon secondary?
I guess so. The Ducks also forcing 2.3 turnovers per game, which ranks 7th in FBS. So this is, even though they've played poorly against Cal and Stanford, this is the biggest test yet for the UW offense and for Jacob Eason.
I'm so fascinated to see this game, right? I mean, it's, we've seen them play against good defenses before in this season, and it hasn't gone particularly well.
No, it's gone quite poorly.
So, but you do have to think, is there an element of things might have turned around a little bit in the last week? Like, are we going to get a good offense, bad offense type situation? I feel like Bush Hamden's out to run the good offense in this game.
Okay. I don't know. I think they're going to come into this game trying to run the ball a lot.
And if they run the ball and the defense plays well, then so be it.
I think, you know, if I look at an optimistic view of this game, it's they run the ball and then are able to take deep shots using play action. And
that's the good offense. That's literally what I'm saying. That is.
I don't think that's necessarily the Seahawks good offense. That's the Seahawks good offense. No, the quick passing that we saw in the second half against Pittsburgh is to me the good offense.
I'm still a little bit skeptical. I think quick passing is so appropriate when necessary, but being able to hit big shots, being able to run the ball consistently and then hit big shots is pretty huge. And if the Huskies can do that, if they can run, and then open up things to be able to throw over the top, if they can actually run play action, for God's sake, run play action, the offense should be able to gain. The passing offense should be able to gain 200 yards in this game.
Okay. I don't know if that's a, they may need more than that to win, although I feel good about this matchup for the UW defense, which also played much better in the second half at Arizona. Some of the credit going to Ariel Nata playing inside linebacker in that game, which has been a trouble spot for the Huskies in terms of their tackling all season long. He's someone who, you know, came in thinking of him more as kind of a rush outside linebacker, but, you know, just to try to get his speed and athleticism on the field, ended up at inside linebacker more.
Well, it is kind of crazy because you look at it, and even after 7 games, right, we really don't have a feel for how good this defense is.
No. We've seen wild highs and lows. I mean, you could say that on both sides of the ball, but it's certainly true on defense.
They're ranked 23rd in FBI, so you would say that it's a pretty good defense in general. But there are times that they can be completely run over, you know, and it'll be fascinating to see. To me, the offense that Oregon runs, though, with trying to run the ball at relatively short clips plus short passing, is
I'd like this offense that tries to run the ball at long clips. I want to do that.
But it's what they do, right? They're not gaining a ton of yards on the ground per play, and they don't pass the ball for a lot of yards. It really is sort of like, it's going to be a bend but don't break defense for the Huskies.
Yes. I mean, what Oregon tries to do passing, I think, really plays into what UW tries to do defensively, which is keep everything in front of you. Now, that puts a premium on tackling, which has been a problem a lot of the time. But, you know, that's been their strength, is they often give up high completion percentages but low yards per completion, much like what we're seeing from Herbert this season in general.
So that's what you give up here, though. I mean, the reality is, as long as field position isn't terrible, it just takes a lot of plays and a lot of first downs to be able to accurately run that offense. And eventually something is going to go wrong, right?
I mean, not a lot of things have gone wrong for Oregon, to be clear, although they haven't necessarily scored a lot of points in all their games. Against Cal, they were, you know, not exactly dominant offense. They scored 17 points in that one. They scored 21 against Stanford. These are teams that beat the Huskies primarily with the fact that they were able to, you know, score a surprising amount of points offensively in those games.
The Huskies still are the best team they've played since Auburn, and they're still playing this game on the road, though.
Yes.
And they're the best team that they've played since Auburn by a pretty significant margin.
Yeah, that's probably true. Although, again, two of the teams they played beat UW. Another potential advantage for the Huskies is special teams. They are ranked 5th in FPI efficiency there.
Look at Coach Pete getting back on track on special teams.
Oregon is 82nd, and particularly the kicking game is a struggle. Camden Lewis, 2 of 5 this season on field goals. You, sir, are no Peyton Henry.
That's it. That's the strategy for the game, right? You can kind of see it laid out there, especially for the defense. It is, you let them do their thing, get them into field goal situations, and then have their 40% field goal kicker kick field goals.
Peyton, I don't even want to talk. Peyton Henry has been so good, I don't even want to talk about it because, for fear of jinxing it. It would be nice if he was able to play a heroic game in this role in this game after the miss last year at Oregon.
It would be nice if he didn't have to.
Also true, but that would be a cool storyline.
I would say that this crowd is going to be pumped and jacked. There's going to be a lot of Oregon fans in the house.
There's
going to
be so many Oregon fans. It's sold out, which is a rarity for Husky Stadium.
It's because there are a lot of Oregon fans.
I'm aware, but I think also Husky fans are more excited for this game than even USC. I mean, again, they are our biggest rivals.
I mean, it's going to be a fun game, but it's like you can clearly see how the game could play out in that way, and Huskies just need to score enough points, whether it's getting a turnover of some kind, short field of some kind, whatever that looks like, and being able to put up 21 points, 24 points, something like that.
Which, again, would be nearly as many as they've allowed over their last five games combined.
I don't think the Huskies are going to run the ball when they're down by five touchdowns.
Probably not. Chances of victory?
57%.
That is wildly cockeyed optimistic.
I mean, they're 3-point favorites. What do you consider?
No, they're not.
Oh, they're...
That's +3, my friend. That is +3.
That is absurd.
It's not, though.
To say that Oregon is a 6-point better team on a neutral field?
I mean, that's pretty much exactly what FPI comes up with, I think.
The Huskies are also better than they've played.
We'll see.
You don't believe that they are?
I'm hopeful they are, but I'm not confident they are yet. FPI has them as 5.8 points better on a neutral field.
Wow.
So that's it. I will say about 40% chance of victory in this game.
40%?
Yeah.
We're beating Oregon.
Just like
you think Justin Herbert.
Just like we were losing to Arizona?
Well, I had a healthy amount of fear about that one. Justin Herbert is not coming in here and beating the Huskies with his dinks and dunks. You can get out of here with that.
I think their defense might be good enough to do it. Again, what of Jacob Eason against an elite-level defense has convinced you that the Huskies' offense is going to be effective in this
Bush
game?
Bush Hamden turned it around last week. Bush Hamden was this close to getting fired.
First off, he was not. Dude's great Wednesday meetings. He incredible Wednesday meetings.
He was this close to getting fired after the year. He's fighting for his job at the end of the season. He knew he had to turn it on offensive-wise.
I don't think that Chris Peterson sees it like the media sees it.
If they would have played another game similar to that Stanford game, Bush was gone.
Agree to disagree.
You really think so?
I mean, I also didn't think Daryl Bevel was getting fired when he did, but... Agree to disagree. That's going to be a good one. I'm excited.
Oh, my God.
I'm also terrified.
I don't know if I can take this weekend of football.
It's going to be a lot. But let's look ahead for a second to some football that won't be played until the spring. And we don't mean the Super Bowl. It's the XFL Seattle Dragons who participated in the XFL first phase of the XFL draft on Tuesday. Key draft picks for the Dragons. In the fifth round of the skill position phase, they drafted Keenan Reynolds, the longtime member of the Seahawks practice squad, along with bringing him back home, Kaysen Williams in the seventh round.
Oh, man.
They shouldn't have waited that long. That was too big of a risk. It's like the fact that the Seahawks actually screwed up by taking Russell Wilson in the third round, because if you knew he was that good, you should have taken him earlier. Bruce Irvin be damned. The Dragons also drafted UW defensive tackle Tanela Tupu in the seventh round of the front seven phase. The draft continues on Wednesday as the Dragons fill out their roster. Notably, another notable draft pick, Kristen Michael, who did almost nothing wrong, drafted sixth overall by the St. Louis Battlehawks in the skill position phase.
Who went number one overall, do you know?
I looked at this and I do not remember who it was, which tells
I'm just
you.
Curious who a hot prospect is in the XFL. I would assume that it would be a quarterback.
Well, so the teams got allocated quarterbacks.
Oh.
Including Landry Jones, Cardale Jones were among those allocated. Matt McGloin, the Dragons were allocated. Brandon Silvers, who played at Troy, you'll remember him, of course. You could also draft players in the skill position phase. But, you know, it wasn't necessarily is much of a priority because you already had one on your roster. So the first pick was James Madison wide receiver Rashard Davis.
Okay.
Followed by Connor Cook did go as a quarterback at number two overall.
Rashard Davis.
Yeah.
Have I told you about my...
those are the only two players I've heard of.
Flag Connor football Cook matchup for this weekend?
No.
You haven't heard about this. I remain undefeated as a flag football coach.
Congrats. Did you actually head coach on Sunday?
No, I basically offensive coordinated.
Okay. Did you call the flea flicker the illegal flea flicker?
The flea flicker is not illegal.
Oh.
And I called it a lot.
Did you? And it worked?
It actually... My misdirection plays didn't work as well this week against the Broncos.
Well, I mean, Vic Fangio is coaching him up.
You know, finally, it took a few weeks in the Fangio defense for them to get settled. But basically, with the flea flicker, it opened up a few different options. So it's like we ran a few different plays out of it. So there was one where it was a traditional flea flicker where we threw it back to the quarterback and had him pass. Another option where they threw it back, had him pretend to pass, and then run.
Uh-huh.
And then another one where we did a fake throwback.
Oh, wow.
So there's a couple of different really options doing once things. You establish it. I also instituted a draw play.
What was the final score here?
The final score? Yeah. 28-16 or something like that.
Okay.
So on the first series of the game, the Broncos scored a long passing touchdown. And I was like, oh, hell no. And the kid who scored did a touchdown dance, which is the first time that I've seen that happen in this league. Did a little dance in the end zone, and I was like, we are beating this team.
No.
I was like, there is no way that we are not winning this game. I was like, y'all just ensured that I'm giving the ball to the good player.
And you did?
Oh, yeah. First play of the game was a touchdown.
There you go.
I was like, be cool out here, Broncos. So it was just not happening after that. Luca, baby fantasy genius.
So I always have a hard time being cool.
Really?
Yeah.
I was very cool as a coach.
That's not what I was talking about.
What were you talking about? Oh, when playing sports?
No, it's something else.
What?
Don't worry about it.
Luca made a very aggressive play on defense where he was diving for a pass, trying to get an interception. And his shoulder or whatever ended up hitting another kid. Everybody started crying. they were down for a while. We all got on a knee. And after the game, Luca felt like he was in trouble because there was a penalty called on the play. And I was telling him that Pete Carroll would say, as long as you're being aggressive and making a play on the ball, he's not upset about that. Wouldn't you agree with that as a secondary player? I feel like he's talked about this, where he's like, if his secondary players are being aggressive and making a play on the ball, he's not upset about it. He wasn't reckless in any way.
I mean, he wants disciplined players who are not, you know, but you want to play to the edge. So, I suppose so.
He was out there playing to the edge. I was like, people get penalties called. Everybody gets penalties called on them.
You know what drives me crazy? This happened a little bit in the bar I was watching the Seahawks game at on Sunday.
Uh-huh.
Which, by the way, there was like a diehard Jacksonville Jaguars fan there.
Uh-huh.
That was something I'd never seen in the wild. When people yell like cheaters after a team gets a penalty, it's like, you know, that's part of the sport. It's not like there's any team that doesn't get penalties.
Yeah, the only cheaters are the refs.
Mm. The Packers-Lions ref?
Yes.
Look.
Maybe the Seahawks refs also. It depends on who
you ask. You know, it's things move quickly out there.
So anyway, just wanted to update you. We're now alone in first place.
Oh, congrats.
The Chiefs. I mean, we definitely have the best player in the league. I would say we have the best player in the league by a fairly significant margin.
So you have the Patrick Mahomes of the league?
If Patrick Mahomes was both the best player on offense and the best player on defense...
Don't give Andy Reid an idea.
We're like Charles Woodson in college, right? He's winning the Heisman, but still, we're undefeated.
Should we turn our attention to the Seahawks, who, with me watching in Oakland, earned a 32-28 win on Sunday over the Cleveland Browns, and oh my God, we're 5-1.
We knew this was coming.
Did we?
No. Could easily be 6-0. That's the thing where it's funny because like you just want to celebrate being 5-1, but also it's just like, they could have beaten the Saints.
And yet they have, you know, won four of these games by what, a combined 8 points?
Don't worry about it. Something like that.
It's close to that. So it's still a little tough to know what to make of the Seahawks. Football Outsiders, their schedule metrics, Seahawks 27th hardest schedule so far, hardest schedule coming up.
Hardest schedule?
Yes.
Wow.
Yeah. I mean, you look at the schedule, like we talked about, there are some games that are looking a little bit easier. The Atlanta Falcons at 1-5.
A little bit, I would say.
Tampa Bay at 2-4, even though there's still the Bruce Arians coming into CenturyLink Field thing. But there's also a lot of very good teams on the schedule, including 5 of the 6 games against the NFC West, or 4 of the 6 games, and they've also played the Rams, which is looking increasingly brutal with the 49ers at 5-0 and a +83 point differential far and away. The best in the NFC.
The thing about future schedules is things can change in an NFL season in 1 week.
True.
Right? So I just, things can change so quickly that I'm not going to dwell on it at this point.
So the fly in the punch bowl.
Okay, fly in the punch bowl.
What, did you have something more on that?
No, I'm just saying we're focusing on this week.
Well, we stick with last week. The fly in the punch bowl of this outcome was the Will Disley injury going down untouched in the end zone with what has not yet been officially diagnosed as a ruptured Achilles, but definitely appears to be a ruptured Achilles coming off of last year's patella injury that cost him the bulk of the season, a second consecutive brutal injury for Will Disley.
Can I just run outside into the rain? Get to my knees and scream at the sky. What? Yeah.
Oh, that's gonna be tough listening.
Thrill. Again.
The thrill is gone again. The thrill was back, and now the thrill is gone.
Come back, thrill.
I miss you.
No words.
just great podcasting.
First you take ballers from us. And now Thrill Disley. It's like, couldn't we just get Kate Otten now? What do we have to do?
Can he just renounce his eligibility? Just become a free agent?
No, that was... I mean, it'll be very interesting to see how it plays out on the field. There are more important players on the field that could have gotten injured, even beyond the extremely obvious ones, right? But Will Disley was having such an incredible season and has basically had an incredible career.
Yeah.
Every game he's been amazing. Played, I don't want him to be like Penny Hardaway or something where we have this.
Whoa, let's be clear. I want him to be Penny Hardaway. Penny Hardaway was an All-NBA first team pick for a year.
Is there somebody went who to played the NBA for Finals last time who was just like amazing for?
Yes, you know who it is.
Who?
It's Greg Oden.
Oh yeah,
had similar injuries.
But we miss you, Thrill. Haven't really heard them doing anything yet to sort of replace him on the roster. At this
so they
point.
Brought Tyron Swiss back to the practice squad. And I'm not sure if they had a tight end in the practice squad after Jacob Hollister got promoted to the active roster last
week.
When
is the trade deadline? Is it next week?
I do not know that either.
I was thinking about...
You got to talk into the microphone.
I was thinking about teams who are sort of in like give-up mode. It feels like maybe the NFL is moving a little bit more toward... like an NBA style, MLB style, where if you're out of the playoffs, you start looking at flipping players for teams that are competitors.
Yes.
And if there was a tight end out there that made sense to trade for, because obviously the tight end depth is...
Did you find anyone?
No.
Yeah, I mean, that is an issue. Tight end depth in general
is an
issue.
You would want... I mean, you have the Patriots re-signing Ben Watson this week, right? Like, most of the tight ends that you would want, you're like, well, brutal loss for the Chargers, but Hunter Henry isn't on the market or whatever, you know? Kind of just going through, it's like there's just not a lot of great tight ends on really bad teams.
So the trade deadline is October 29th. But of course, the other option for the Seahawks is eligible to come off the IR in week 9 is Ed Dixon.
And I think that's basically what they're holding out for.
I think so too. I mean, we'll probably see a lot more of Hollister. Obviously, it's amazing that Luke Wilson has gone from the sad being cut on Hard Knocks at the end of Hard Knocks 2. He is now the Seahawks' number one tight end right now.
That's what I'm saying about football being different from week to week, though.
Fair.
Football comes at you fast.
Life comes at you fast as well, but football particularly comes at you fast. So the Will Dissly loss offset to some extent by the fact that the Seahawks will this week get back Jaron Reed from his suspension for a domestic incident. The Seahawks 28th in pressure rate so far per Pro Football Reference did not have a sack in Sunday's game, although Ziggy Ansah did force a fumble.
Maybe Tyler Eifert's out there.
Reed had 31 pressures Hooper. Last year.
30th, this is the best I've come up with.
I don't have to trade him. 30th in the NFL and second on the Seahawks behind Frank Clark. So, you know, he definitely will help in that regard. Gives the Seahawks another interior pass rusher to go along with Quentin Jefferson, who's been quite good in that role.
There's something different about getting interior pressure.
Yeah. Flushes the quarterback in a different way than, you know, edge pressure does.
And there's been a lot of debate about how pressure turns into sacks, basically. Like, what goes into making a sack?
And the importance of pressure and sacks in general relative to coverage.
Pressure, secondary, quarterbacks, etc. But I don't think Frank Clark has that many sacks last year without Jaron Reed also being a factor. And this is something that...
He certainly isn't having that many sacks this year in Kansas City.
We haven't seen... I mean, we've seen Jadeveon Clowney be important and Ezekiel Ansah be important. We haven't seen them make huge pressure plays. That play where...
We have seen them make huge plays. We haven't seen them make plays consistently, I think would be the more accurate.
Well, and also getting to the quarterback consistently. And I think it might take a few weeks for Jaron Reed to get back to sort of NFL speed. But once he's there, I do think that we're going to start seeing... Maybe this is just being optimistic. I think the thing that we will see the biggest impact on is those players and how they look like they're performing.
I mean, certainly you look at that group on paper. If you can, on rushdowns, you know, put a foursome out there of Reed, Jefferson, Ansah, and Clowney, like, get on paper, that looks really good.
Well, and who else do they have out there otherwise instead of Jaron Reed? They have...
Puna Ford, probably.
Puna Ford, Al Woods out there, LJ yeah. Collier. Like, the drop-off is pretty huge. Did Jaron Reed go to the Pro Bowl last year?
I don't remember.
At the very least, he was close, right? He is a fringe Pro Bowl player. I mean, this is a massive upgrade that they're bringing in.
So, I mean, the fact that they've gone 5-1 in Reed's absence, even though it's against the easiest part of their schedule, is encouraging.
Yes. And the defense has been the weakest part of the team during that time period. So if they can just get it a little bit back.
The fact that the NFC West is so good is the discouraging part of starting 5-1. Because in addition to the 49ers, the Rams strengthened their team on Tuesday by trading for Jalen Ramsey.
It's the NFC West is real weird, right?
Yes, it is.
It's been discussed at length, but I do think there's just what success does is, especially when it's sort of equitable success, is it means that you end up in these arms races, right? And yeah. You look at these acquisitions and you're like, wow, D Ford was a massive acquisition. The 49ers draft Nick Bosa. And the Seahawks pick up Jadeveon Clowney. And then the Rams are like, we didn't do any of those things this offseason, really. They lost Ndamukong Suh.
They did add Fowler this offseason, right?
I think that was 2 years ago. That they had Dante Fowler? Maybe that was this offseason. But no, that was 2 years ago mid-year. That they traded for Dante that's Fowler. Right. He had a sack against the Seahawks like 2 years ago. But so you sort of have this arms race with these teams, and it's like the Rams now are sitting at 3-3, and they're like, it's time to leverage the future right now.
Yeah.
Right?
I mean, especially before Jared Goff's extension kicks in. Their cap situation becomes.
As far as like assets and resources, the Rams don't look good 2-3 years from now.
They are burning through a lot of resources.
And they're really going all in on a team where it's like, is this the time to go all in? You know, to me, the team that is building it up. So basically, when you look at the four teams in the NFC West, at this moment, the 49ers have what is the best defense in the NFL, probably, and are playing extremely well. Huge concerns, though, at quarterback still. You know, if the 49ers get into a game where their defense is pushed a little bit, turnovers, whatever, they're going to have to be relying on Jimmy Garoppolo to try to get them back into games. You have the Rams, who have bolstered their secondary. They're also 3-3, though, and again, have massive concerns at quarterback. The reason that I would feel, as one of these teams who's competing with them, very good, is at the most important position on the entire team by such a significant margin, we know we have one of the best two or three players in the league.
I mean, right now, the best player in the league. The MVP frontrunner.
Right now, the best player in the league. And so you're saying the reason that the Rams are going out and getting Jalen Ramsey is not necessarily because of that loss to the 49ers. It is, but they didn't lose to the 49ers because their defense wasn't playing well. It was because of their offense. That's why they lost that game, right?
Yeah.
Jared Goff threw for 75 yards.
Wait, did he?
Yeah, he had a 1.1 in fantasy.
Oof, boy.
They made that move because they know in their division there is the best player in the league. And they know coming right behind them, you have Kyler Murray, who also looks good.
Yeah.
Right? It is dangerous across the board. They're leveraging their future right now because of how scared they are of that. And also, they're 3-3, and they have to make a move. And Jared Goff ain't going nowhere. They're committed to him. Jimmy Garoppolo ain't going nowhere. They're committed to him.
So the other related move the Rams made affects this week's Seahawks game. They, to make room for Ramsey, traded cornerback Marcus Peters, the UW product, to Baltimore for backup linebacker Kenny Young in a 2020 fifth-round pick. So Peters will come to CenturyLink Field for the second time this season, having already played with the Rams on Thursday Night Football less than 2 weeks ago.
Hello. Marcus Peters, welcome home.
You seem maybe a little too excited about that. It's not been a great season for Peters, but the Seahawks didn't exactly roast him in that game necessarily.
Do the Rams have a cornerback opposite Jalen Ramsey?
Well, Aqib Talib got placed on IR, right?
Yeah, and they traded Marcus Peters.
I mean, I'm sure they're going to run out a second cornerback, but I don't know.
Nickel Roby?
No, he's strictly a nickelback. You can't, with a name like Nickel, you can't play anything else. You can't play boundary corner.
That's where I'm just like, when there was chatter about the Seahawks being interested in Jalen Ramsey, the idea of spending a lot of resources. Two first-round picks. Plus the amount that they're going to have to pay him.
Yeah.
This is an absurd amount. Like, they went Percy Harvin all in on this.
Yeah.
And I'm going to knock on wood again. The chances of them making a Super Bowl with Jalen Ramsey on the roster, or at least winning a Super Bowl, probably aren't that high, considering the division they're in and the conference they're in at large, right? But also, they're spending that kind of money and resources on a player that you can throw it to all the rest of the field. An individual corner can only be so important.
Seems to be working pretty well for the Niners with their shutdown corner.
You don't think it's the rest of their defense?
I'm not saying it's not the rest of their defense. I'm saying it's working out well for them.
They did not trade two first-round picks for Richard Sherman.
No, I agree. It was a good decision. I'm just saying.
We'd all love to have Richard Sherman back.
The Ravens having issues at cornerback, where Jimmy Smith has missed the last five games with a knee injury. His replacements, Maurice Kennedy and Anthony Averett, have struggled, particularly Averett statistically. According to Pro Football Reference's advanced stats tracking, he is allowing 71% completions on the targets against him for 9.5 yards per target.
So, he's probably the one who's going to the bench then for Marcus Peters.
Yeah, I mean, both of those guys.
He will not get to meet DK Metcalf.
Yeah, I mean, they also haven't played inside at nickel, so probably will not see them on the field. Of course, the story of the season for Baltimore is Lamar Jackson's progression. He is sixth in QBR after ranking 31st as a rookie who took over for Joe Flacco midseason. Jackson's completion percentage up from 58% to 65%. Not running quite as frequently, but is 6.7 yards per attempt, lead all NFL players. The Seahawks notably have only faced one quarterback ranked in the top 20 in QBR thus far, that being Kyler Murray, who's 12th. So this is a big step up in quality in terms of opponent quarterback play.
Is it that dissimilar of an offense, though?
There's some similarities. I mean, Baltimore definitely more successful still through the ground than through the air, on the ground than through the air. They are first in rushing DVOA, 18th in passing DVOA. But There's just more weapons in an offense that is better suited to Jackson's needs now. Marquise Brown, who missed last week with an ankle injury, is averaging 15.5 yards per completion. Willie Snead, 14.9 yards per completion, offering the Ravens a deep play threat that really makes sense with Jackson in the play action. Tight end Mark Andrews is the leading receiver and the guy that he really looks to most often, has been limited in practice with a listed shoulder injury, but did play last week.
So basically that fear of Lamar running, right, on the defensive side is opening up huge holes for Mark Ingram.
Yes.
Right? I mean, you can imagine that a read option, right, where the defense is so terrified of Lamar as a threat. There's something almost like emotionally worse about giving up the yards to the quarterback than the running back also, where I bet the Seahawks are spending more time concerned with Lamar Jackson than they are with Mark Ingram.
That's probably true. There's consistent statistical evidence that rushing quarterbacks help their running backs yards per carry. We saw it with Russell Wilson when he came in and Marshawn Lynch, who had the best season of his career to that point.
I mean, I've tried to explore it as an offensive coordinator. Unfortunately, the quarterback can't run the ball though. So,
tough break unless he gets it back on the flea flicker.
Yeah, we're gonna implement some RPOs soon though.
Okay, good. Defensively, the Ravens 21st in pass defense DVOA, 18th in rush defense DVOA. The pass defense struggles, as we mentioned, really relate into that second corner spot, despite the fact that their primary corner, Marlon Humphrey, has been really outstanding, allowing just 3.7 yards per target, according to that Pro Football Reference tracking. And, of course, they have, I don't know if you've ever heard of him, they have a really good free safety. His name is Earl Thomas. And he's allowing just 3.8 yards per target with 10 total targets through 5 games. And no, this is not painful at all to see him come back to Seattle.
It's really not. Is it painful?
Yeah, it is.
I don't know. No, it's good. Earl Thomas to be playing well.
Sure, I'm happy for him.
And
but
on a good team. It's painful because you're like, we could have Michael Bennett and Richard Sherman and Earl Thomas.
I mean, at some point, the cap hits might become a problem with all three of those guys and everyone else who's on the roster, but yes.
Imagine if you could just swap out no one and slide in those three onto this defense. Things would look a lot different.
Yeah, now you're talking about why the 49ers were able to stay so good for so long before the salary cap existed.
But at the same time, I mean, you're talking about Earl Thomas playing on a defense that is 21st in pass defense DVOA. Granted, it's related to one player, but that's the thing, is you can exploit one player and have a bad defense overall. And I mean, it's part of the reason why you don't necessarily invest too much money into a single player.
Yeah.
So, in a lot of ways, the Rams defense is worse than the Seahawks. And I think the Seahawks passing attack...
You mean the Ravens defense?
Or sorry, the Rams is too.
They're about the same, basically.
They're both teams that are winning games. They're historically good defenses, defensive teams that are winning games by how good their offense is, right?
Yes.
And kind of how they're dynamic their offense is. It's been kind of interesting to sort of see these two teams, and especially with the Ravens investing in defense this offseason. But the Ravens have an excellent rushing attack. The Seahawks have an excellent passing attack coming into this game, right? Both of them have semi-questionable defenses. Could we see a shootout at CenturyLink? Could we see a Texans-style shootout between these two teams?
I mean,
we've got AFC coming to the clink. Maybe the most fun quarterback in the NFL playing here.
Yeah, Russell Wilson will be there.
The best. We've got, in fantasy, the number one and number two quarterbacks. And you know who number one is?
Lamar?
It's Russ.
Really?
The number one fantasy quarterback.
Yeah, I'm glad I have him in one of my leagues. I mean, I just don't think we can define it as like an unusual thing for the Seahawks to play a shootout anymore. It used to be. But now that's just kind of how they play football.
They got down 20-6, and I mean, I was nervous, but I didn't say this game's over.
No. I mean, you look at the Rams game the week before, like,
yeah, you just
offenses controlled that one.
Hope that Russ's headset goes out so you can run a good offense for one series.
So the Seahawks better in terms of GVOA in both offense and defense, and better overall. But the one notable advantage for the Ravens, special teams, where they rank third in the league, and the Seahawks, after Sunday's debacle, down to 28th in the league.
They did get a blocked punt.
Sure.
Debacle?
Yeah.
I missed the opening kickoff. They took the opening kickoff back really far.
I also missed the opening kickoff. Okay.
I was blissfully unaware of the opening kickoff.
I was aware of it, but I did not see it. Apparently, there was a block in the back, according to Pete Carroll. Also, Jason Myers missed an extra point.
There was a block in the back, according to Pete Carroll.
Yeah, I saw the Sidian in the league.
It was probably the worst non-call all weekend.
Oh, come on.
That's really funny, though. That's what they took away from it. I mean, do you think that officiating in that Browns game, do you think it was lopsided in any way?
I mean, the what was it, a personal foul that was there was some sort of phantom call that went in the Seahawks' favor, right?
The one on Landry, on Jarvis Landry, where it was a block in the back and he did not block in the back?
Maybe, yeah. There was definitely like one call that was like, look, that, but I don't think it was that one because it was later in the game, wasn't it? Was that fairly early?
That was in like the third quarter.
But I mean, I don't know if it should have been like the dominant storyline coming out of that game.
No, and I think that's what the Browns felt like. It was the story of the game. And I'm like, you kind of threw three picks, fumbled, and had a punt blocked.
I mean, right? That to me was the story of the game, is non-repeatable turnovers working in the Seahawks' favor.
They were, and they all, a lot of them seemed to come off tips and things.
Yeah.
They got lucky.
They've been doing plenty of that this season.
But they didn't get lucky in the same way that Russell Wilson led them down 2 points consistently.
True.
So, but for this Ravens game, I think that we should go in expecting a shootout. And it's going to be, there's a very good chance that this is one of the most fun games that we see in CenturyLink.
I hope so.
All that said, percentage of chances of victory for Seahawks and Ravens, Earl Thomas's return home.
58%. Decided to go with a non-round number here.
What's the spread here? Seahawks by 3?
Yeah. 3.5.
They're even teams, basically, on a neutral field.
Seahawks by 0.5 on a neutral field. They're
3.5.
Yeah.
I think they have a 65% chance of victory. It just sort of adds up when you add the numbers up. It's a better offense. It's a better defense. The chances of, it's funny to use the Bengals as an arbiter of this.
Let's not use the Bengals as an arbiter.
Probably should have lost to the Bengals, but the Ravens have looked unimpressive in a lot of games.
Yeah, the common opponents, both teams have played Cincinnati at home, the Seahawks winning by 1, the Ravens last week winning by 6. Both teams have played at Pittsburgh, the Seahawks winning by 2 in a game that Ben Roethlisberger left at halftime with an injury, or just before halftime, I guess, and the Ravens winning in overtime by 3 in a game that...
ugly game.
...was started by Mason Rudolph, but finished by Devlin Hodges. Is that his name?
Devlin Hodges.
Yeah, okay.
That's a...
Oh, and then...
1-0 starting quarterback, Devlin Hodges.
Both of these teams also have played Cleveland, the Ravens losing 40-25 at home, the Seahawks, of course, getting last week's win. And both teams have played Arizona. I guess they're all common opponents. Four of the 6 games have been common opponents. The Ravens winning by 6 at home, the Seahawks winning by 17 on the road. So I guess they do get the edge in terms of common opponents. I will say that.
But all of these games since Miami, they played pretty well at Kansas City, which all of a sudden playing pretty well at Kansas City. Granted, things are different with an injured Mahomes, but
since he got the fully guaranteed contract, he's just coasting.
Phoning it in. Playing pretty well at Kansas City doesn't necessarily mean the same thing that it did 4 weeks ago.
No, I guess not.
So I think they've been kind of ugly games. This will be a wild game, but the Seahawks are going to come up. They're going to win this game by more than a touchdown.
What? You just said that was naive to think that the Seahawks might get a comfortable victory.
I didn't say they're going to win it comfortably. I said they're going to win by more than a touchdown.
Okay, that sounds pretty comfortable to me. Again, the Seahawks wins the season by 4-1-17. 2-1.
Jaron Reed's back.
Sure is.
We have the best player in the NFL, and Jaron Reed's back. Come on.
Anything more on the Seahawks?
Fired up for this weekend.
Well, we're going to keep our attention on the NFC West, but it's time to change subjects to conclude the show. We're pouring one out tonight for the finale, the series finale of, I guess, the official TV show of the Peltoncast, Ballers on HBO. And for one final, one conclusive After Ballers, the only person we could talk to after the successful After Ballers at the live Peltoncast in September was to bring back our friend and third Pelton brother, DJ Infrared, the biggest Ballers at HBO fan we know. Thanks for joining us again.
I am a ballerholic. Is that that was actually a local sports brand. I remember back in my youth, it was the ballerholic in my basketball days. So I guess I think I have some of those old shorts. I might start wearing that and mourning the end of the show.
And mourn we definitely will.
It's appropriate.
After a thrilling conclusion to Ballers on HBO. To summarize the season, if you weren't watching Ballers, can you actually give a quick summary, Kevin? Because I feel like you're the one who remembers it the best. Or Infra, do you want to do a quick summary of what happened this season of Ballers on HBO? Spoiler alert to everybody out there. Yeah, that's the important thing to remember.
If for some reason you actually do not want Ballers on HBO to be spoiled, then turn off the podcast now.
Yeah, I urge you to skip ahead. A quick synopsis. Well, The Rock owns the Chiefs. That's one thing. Charles Green is the GM of the Rams, coming off of a fresh Super Bowl loss, and also hunting for Alvin Kamara as well. he had the advanced intel that Todd Gurley was already past his prime.
That one was half ripped from the headlines, half not. The Rams went to the Super Bowl,
yeah,
and then Todd Gurley disappeared from the face of the earth.
Yeah.
And Alvin Kamara's a free agent now.
He's a free agent who fired his agent, so. Vernon seemingly quit the NFL to become an e-gamer until he wasn't.
Oh, boy.
Until a $90 million contract extension landed on his desk. Odell Beckham, with his old haircut, is apparently a sports management magistrate in his spare time.
As one does.
And Rob Corddry is building, the world's leading state-of-the-art training facility, in which he, at the construction site, just mildly utters that the costs have actually run 100% of their initial projection.
He's definitely building something.
I mean, to me, that rung very familiar to the Key Arena renovations.
Yeah. I just wonder who's on the hook for what. And then what else happened?
The Rock and Joe Crutell, Rob Corddry, they mended their rift.
I want to talk about that more later.
Yeah, there was a blood feud between them at the start of the season, and then it disappeared.
Yes.
Shocking.
Oh, and also the tragic murder of Juan Kassan Teague. Mm.
Yeah, after a video surfaced of him shooting in the Jack in the Box parking lot.
After him failing to murder someone, I found sympathy for his own murder.
So
it's a tragic cycle.
I would say that's oh no, you have more to ask.
Well, there's a lot more happened. That happened. Ricky Jarrett, first, so he tested positive for PEDs.
Uh-huh.
Then he got a contract extension. Then he celebrated the contract extension in the middle of the street and got run over by a car and tore his ACL.
Oh, yeah.
Then he retired, and then he started hosting a show on Sirius XM and all of a sudden became a big figure. And then he decided that he didn't want to get into producing for a Hollywood corporation and instead started producing his own documentary.
Let me just say, Ricky, like to Ricky Jarrett really, he had a season.
So prolific. A lot going on.
A lot happened to him, but he also, he pivoted to video faster than anybody pivoted to video.
Wow.
He did two episodes on the radio, and then boom, was straight to video right after that.
I have to assume it was more than two episodes.
Well, yeah, I do enjoy the giant reveal that the the entire time it was him interviewing The Rock the entire season. That was very, very well written, very very elusive of them.
Oh yeah, Rashard Mendenhall worked for a long time on that one. Yeah. I just can't even believe the season for Ricky Jarrett. Because The Rock, I mean, he had to buy the Chiefs, right? Which happened. That took one episode for him to complete that multiple billion-dollar purchase. And then he pretty much just had Chiefs-related business after that.
I mean, I would say, like, him doing that interview, which we had seen clips of all season long, had underlied the entire season. And it seemed like it was going to be something related to his purchase of the Chiefs. And then I guess it sort of was, but it turned out it wasn't. Not since the St. Elsewhere finale and the snow globe has there been as shocking a turn at the end of a series.
The best part of that interview is that it wasn't even the exclusive, because he gave that to the newspaper reporter before he actually sat down.
Yeah, I guess this was a larger thing about his whole life and journey to this point.
Ricky Jarrett's doing like a 30 for 30 or something.
So the other thing that happens with The Rock is that he goes to Kasan Tiq's funeral, meets a retired NFL player, and all of a sudden decides that the only thing that matters to him is pension or like lifelong health care for retired NFL players. So this becomes his sole crusade the remainder of the season.
For the two episodes.
Yes.
Yeah, so did he, the whole NCAA lawsuit, that just never happened, that they settled that?
He also was in a relationship in episode one, right?
Well, that was the woman that he was in a relationship with in season two, and she just had to go back to ESPN where she's working.
Oh, so she was just at ESPN the whole season?
Yeah.
Okay.
She was vacationing in Miami and says that she has to get back to she doesn't say Bristol.
She had to return. She now had to return to her home planet. So I have some important questions here about this season of Ballers on HBO.
Okay.
Really just statements. Number one, what do you think was on Odell Beckham's mood board for that game against the Seahawks last Sunday?
Oh, no.
I think it might have been a picture of Joe's girlfriend.
I think it was a lot of Baker Mayfield interceptions, apparently.
Drop passes, interceptions. He mood boards every game, though.
I had forgotten that.
Infrared, I want to apologize to you and Beering, of course. My past behavior had less to do with you and more to do with my own misery. You're a valuable member of this team.
I mean, it's just like all that has to happen is The Rock had to say, hey, I'm sorry that we stopped working together. And that's literally the only thing that had to happen for Joe Cartel to finally have a good mental state
Rob
for the
Corddry
first time in
peace.
5 years of this series. I do not get it.
I had to push everyone away before I realized that I was the problem.
It's valuable like, lesson.
One of the central parts of the season is this fight between Spence and Rob Corddry, which is funny because The Rock is way more famous than Rob Corddry, but I know him by his name on the show, and Joe Cartel just doesn't seem right to me. But, because he is Spencer Strassmore. And then, so that's like the central point of the season, and this is the most Ballers way to handle things. Really, I mean, all of the finale seasons of HBO this year, they're just getting stuff over with quick. But, they talk for 30 seconds.
They immediately go from they can't even see each other without insulting the other one to just completely made up.
Pats on the back, like, hugging. He's like, I'm sorry. I shouldn't have left you. And Rob Corddry's like, wow, that's it. That's what I needed to hear.
It was nonsensical.
They did it just in time to give Patrick Mahomes the contract that would ignite the feud.
So can we talk about this for a second?
The Mahomes contract.
It does not seem improbable to me that Patrick Mahomes would get a fully guaranteed contract extension. Fucking Kirk Cousins got a fully guaranteed contract. And while I grant that it was only 3 years, have you ever watched Kirk Cousins and Patrick Mahomes play football? Kirk Cousins to Patrick Mahomes is like Ballers on HBO to any other show on television.
Oh, no. Well, first of all, how dare you? Ballers on HBO is the Lamar Jackson of TV shows. This is the most fun show. This is the Patrick Mahomes of TV shows.
Oh, come on.
You cannot look away when Ballers on HBO is on.
Which MVP has this Ballers on HBO one?
I have to admit that I think, much like Shooter McGavin or Bossman, depending on how you are aware of him.
Yeah, definitely Shooter McGavin.
When I saw that initial Kirk Cousins contract at the time, I think I might have won. I'm going to throw my remote through my TV.
Fair. That's reasonable. I mean, we're trending in that direction. Julio Jones's contract is nearly fully guaranteed. Come on, Ballers. Read the room.
Read the room. Look, Ballers is out there predicting the 18-game season. Like, they were being safe on the Mahomes contract.
I suspect that maybe the contract has the pension plan in it, which, if true, feels like a violation of the salary cap. But maybe that's what angered the owners. Who knows?
Yeah, I don't know how that would work. Yeah,
fully guaranteed, arguably the future of the league and the most dynamic quarterback that we may ever see doesn't seem to be all too upsetting.
Right,
especially it's not preposterous. The owner of the Dallas Cowboys,
who also somehow is the commissioner of the league.
Oh, so he's just he's the owner. I forgot that he was the owner of the Cowboys.
It took me the longest time to figure out that Charles Green's boss is the owner of the Rams, because it's never made clear, at least that, I mean, in my close reading of Ballers, it's never was clear to me until he announced that he was going to promote him to president, because I thought that he might be the president and CEO.
He
of
was the
team.
The president. Yeah.
His name, by the way, you know who that actor's name is?
This is my favorite thing about that organization, that apparently has been running without a president the entire time. He's just like, would you kill president?
The one thing
they've got, that like weird intern kid who mentions that he has a job offer from the Browns. Charles Green yells at him, and then he's like, well, my boss yelled at me, therefore I'm not going to bring up this job offer from another team again.
So I assume he's now the GM. If Charles Green is the president,
yeah, I guess
I have
that
to assume
sense.
That they've now made that turn. I wasn't talking to you. I just mentioned how the intern is now the Sean McVay of GMs.
Okay. Yeah.
Yes.
The actor who plays the owner, his name is Kevin Durand.
Kevin Durand, because I see that name all the time.
Yeah. Yeah. It's in the credits. My actual favorite part of this season was the cameo of Rams' actual GM, Les Snead, in the cafeteria, where weirdly they have to pay for their own lunch, apparently.
They put it on the owner's tab.
I gotta have questions.
I wanted to ask you, in your experience, how close is that lunchroom to like the famed Bristol lunchroom? Is there any, do they have any insight, any inside information? Do they pull any inspiration?
First off, I have not been since they renovated the lunchroom in Bristol, but I don't know that I would recognize any specific similarity.
I would have had no idea that they renovated.
But I really don't understand. Like, I was imagining that Shooter McGavin was the commissioner now.
I guess he just serves both roles, which does not seem like a good situation.
Just like Kevin Durand is both owner and president. But also, it doesn't make sense why he has to be so creepy.
No. That's just Kevin Durand going for it. Okay, what else do you have on this season?
That's why the Rams succeeded, is his irreverence as an owner.
So also, I was imagining, what do you think the conversation was like for the real mean Charles Green, Les Snead, like you mentioned? They were like, they're in the office and they were like, Justin Coleman is available. We know we need corner help. And he's like, no, better. And they're like, Darius Slay? And he's like, mm-mm, we're the Rams. I need a Ramsey.
Wow. Well done.
They're like, go out and get me Ramsey at all costs.
I think I've seen the best tweet related to that from Katie Nolan. She said more like Jalen Ramsey, and that's just perfection.
He definitely was hanging out in a bakery in Hollywood.
I mean, he might have been.
And Les Snead cornered him.
He was in Houston for the game a couple weeks ago, right?
I do feel like it is a little baller's ass to forfeit the next 5 years of first round draft picks. That would only exist in that universe.
Yes.
Yes.
Or draft day, perhaps.
The draft day sequel.
So then really a lot happens in the finale. Basically, they go back and they're like, the entire point of the season is that whatever an athlete wants to do is going to work out. Yeah. Right? That's like kind of a thing. It's like Spencer, former athlete, can now own the Chiefs. Vern can be a very successful gaming player or whatever.
Well, we gotta talk about this for a second. He was going to take the contract for the Cowboys the entire time, and it was just a motivation tool?
That was, okay, no, this is what I want to say, though. Ricky Jarrett just, like, decides he wants to be on the radio and then has a successful radio show. But then
I think that,
like,
one's pretty plausible.
Vern being, like, caring only about gaming the entire season, being completely uninterested with football, and then being, like, and they finish second and make $750,000, which somehow is not enough to cover the entry fee.
Preposterous.
And then he's like, gaming can wait.
He's like, nah, just play it. It was I just can't. I can't.
Dude, Vern's out there playing 4D chess.
So was he holding out? Because they made a really big deal of Patrick Mahomes not being in camp. And Vernon is just gaming the entire time.
Yeah, I guess so. The timing of all of this happening is really unclear.
It's maybe a non-linear timeline of ballers on HBO.
Oh, they're going with a Jeremy Barrowy time structure.
So then they do the Seinfeld finale. They get all the guests from the season, right? All the athletes who have been on there. Spence has to call them all. Bring everybody back for a second. Show the horrific Navarro Bowman injury, which nobody wants to see. Then they do the vote. Spence delivers his impassioned speech about this thing that he has literally cared about for one episode before this. And he's like, owners, we need health care for every single player that has been in the league for 3 years. They mock him, right? Shooter McGavin can't believe that he would request this. Spence, they go to the vote. He's like, all right, I'll take a vote. So they're like, do you agree? Do you want to vote in? 2/3 vote, health care for all players who've played for 3 years. Spencer's the only person who raises his hand. Drama. Then one by one, each owner stands on the desks. Oh, captain, my captain, there will be insurance for these players. And it comes down to Shooter McGavin, owner of the Cowboys / commissioner of the league. And he's like, my answer is yes.
So I was taking that as a Spartacus scene. Like, everyone was stepping forward to say, I am Spartacus.
I am Spartacus.
But you left out the motivating factor, which is the coordinated influencer Instagram campaign that Spencer launched from his porch.
And it led them to threaten to strike, which I don't know that I don't know that Spencer Strasbourg is going to have that kind of power.
This show also really believes in the power of a feature in USA Today or whatever.
Yeah. That.
Well, I'm glad someone still believes in print journalism.
Also believing that the NFL Players Association would strike in 2019.
Yeah, that's a bit of a stretch.
Just one note. I feel like if you're going to conduct a secret meeting with the Players Association, it might not be wise to drive a $400,000 Rolls-Royce SUV to the meeting that is synonymous with you.
There are eyes everywhere.
Yes.
As he was reminded, there are eyes everywhere.
Then they pull back. We find out it's a video all along as made by Ricky Jarrett. Minds are blown. God, I'm going to miss ballers.
And then the groundbreaking where The Rock shows up late and is the last person feted by Rob Corddry in the best mood of his life, basically. As it turns out, it turns out he did find love.
Yes. I do enjoy the Frost Nixon esque reveal of that final interview.
That's really what they're building toward all year. Okay, before we conclude, we wrap up the series of Ballers on HBO. Any other thoughts on this compelling final season?
Oh boy, just
Quavo is an absolutely awful actor.
What did they say? Oh my god, that was so good when Quavo popped up. I'm like, I'm standing. This is like the Seahawks just beat the Rams. I'm standing when he pops up out of nowhere. Just it was just like
randomly in the same place at the same time on the set, on the lot.
They definitely were in that last minute. They're like, oh fuck, Quavo wants to be a guest on the show. We've got 13 minutes left. We need to work him in somewhere fast.
I just enjoy that. In the history of shows that have been on HBO and the quality of them, from Game of Thrones to Sopranos to The Wire, they had a show where you could clearly see someone trying to remember their lines.
Broken. I can't do it anymore.
He walks off and they're like, oh, Quavo.
That Quavo.
I was like, it felt also like they were a little bit trying to remind people who he was.
Which frankly, they might have needed to do with some of the NFL cameos. Players wear helmets most of the time.
Oh, I recognize Quavo way more than I do.
Oh, yeah.
Like Alvin Kamara? No idea.
Melvin Gordon?
Yeah.
Yeah, Melvin Gordon. I didn't even know he was on there until I was listening to the Ringer was talking. And they're like, Melvin Gordon was guested on this episode. And I was like, huh. Definitely did not know
I
that.
I saw his name on the list at the end in the credits.
I'll start us off here. But wanted to say, what was this season of Ballers on HBO? We've had throughout time. We just had initially Ballers on HBO.
Yes.
We had the brilliant second season of Ballers on HBO.
Was that the critically acclaimed one? Which one is the critically
one was critically acclaimed.
I don't think it actually was brilliant. Critically acclaimed.
One was actually, I think, a disappointing. That might have been the fourth season.
Yeah.
So for me, this final season of Ballers on HBO, after such an important vote that The Rock helped push through, and that thing that he's cared about for 47 minutes, I think this was the important final season of Ballers on HBO.
Wow. I'm going to go with the overly tidy final season of Ballers on HBO because literally everything got resolved happily at the end. Like, there was always the central tension of the show to which this is based, the show on which this is based and to which it is often compared.
I was gonna say,
Entourage.
It's based off Entourage.
Yeah.
Ballers is life, though.
Because people are always like, look, they can't make everything a happy ending, but you also don't want it to be like too down on Ballers or on Entourage. Like, what you're here for is to see people having fun. But here it was like everyone got exactly what they wanted in the end. And like, come on, man. That's not realistic.
Sometimes Vinny needs a drug problem. All right, Infrared, take us home for all of Ballers. What was this season?
The very special final episode or final season of Ballers.
I like
many,
it.
Many issues were tackled.
Well, it was a fun ride through The Rock's vanity project, despite being maybe the most famous actor on Earth, that he blessed us with these five seasons of Ballers on HBO. Thank you so much for being here to memorialize what we experienced over these last 5 years. And Fred, thank you.
I will be eagerly buying the DVD box set or Blu-ray box set, I guess, if that comes out. This was a great moment in time and in my life, and I'm proud to be a part of the Baller Brotherhood, and hopefully we'll see the show as entertaining as it very soon.
Oh man, they set the bar so high.
I just want one with the NBA now.
I mean, they tried that with Survivor's Remorse, and it didn't really take.
It wasn't fun enough.
I guess not.
Okay, now do baseball then.
On that note.
Thanks for listening. This is the end?
Yeah,
this is the end of the podcast? All right, thanks for listening.
Thanks.